about the biblical work ethic, 6 days shalt thou labor, not 6 days shalt thou loiter, buying lottery tickets. All right, and we learned that God commissioned man to be his vice agent here on the earth, to rule the earth, subdue the earth, to cultivate the potential of the earth for man's own benefit. All of that is legitimate. The curse connected with labor comes after the fall. And the curse is simply that frustration and strain would also accompany work. And we all know that to be true. Not all work is pleasant. But the work ethic is foundational to Sabbath law. It is only upon the foundation of preceding labor that our vocation, in our vocation, that the rest on the Sabbath is to be reared, says Euler in his Theology of the Old Testament. The 6 days of labor is just as much a part of the Sabbath law as the part about the rest. Now, the work ethic is praised in the wisdom literature over and over again. Proverbs praises the work ethic. You can look up those verses. Ecclesiastes regards work as a gift from the Lord. And I do not understand how it has come to be in this country where the work ethic is what built this country, that we've wound up with so many people, and even a lot of Christian people, and I'm afraid even some kids on this campus that are not even willing to do labor in order to stay in school in some cases. And that's the difference between having to stay, they're perfectly willing to be here as long as somebody's handing it to them on a silver platter, but if you have to get out and do any work, as most of us had to do to get through college, they're not willing to do that. And so the work ethic has really suffered in recent years. The New Testament sanctifies the work ethic. Now, there's some symbolic sanctification of work under the law, because not only do you have this principle that labor belongs to the Lord and is of the Lord, but you also have that represented in various rituals. One of those is the ritual of the first fruits, where the first bushel of wheat that was harvested in the wheat in the field was brought as a gift to the Lord. And that symbolized that all of the result of the labor belonged to the Lord. So that was a symbolic sanctification or setting apart of work. There is even in the law a concept of what I call circumcised work, which sounds strange. But the regulation was, once they got into the land of Canaan, for 3 years, the fruit of the trees must be pinched off and allowed to rot on the ground. In the 4th year, the fruit could be eaten if it was redeemed, taking its value, adding 20% to it. It belonged to the Lord. In the 5th year, for the first time, they could eat the fruit off of the trees. Yes, a hand goes up.
I have a report on that.
Oh, tell us about it.
Many of the trees were citrus trees, and all the trees are fig trees, and that the people weren't allowed to pick off for 3 years, and the tree was considered to be uncircumcised, and that the 4th year, the fruit was dedicated to the Lord, and in the 5th year, Israel could pick from the trees, and that this waiting to pick the trees would yield the highest harvest by the 5th year.
Okay, so you see the main purpose of this as being to increase productivity?
Well,
now, did you analyze what you found? Oh, we have another hand. Miss Harris will solve that question for you.
One commentator said, perhaps the fruit produced in the first 3 years is not thought to be an acceptable offering to the Lord. The expression uncircumcised is a Hebrew way of saying it is forbidden to you.
Good.
And another one says, the fruit from the trees during the first 3 years was to be considered unclean or forbidden, while that of the 4th year was to be dedicated to the Lord as an offering of thanksgiving.
Okay, good. It's just peculiar. It uses this phrase uncircumcised in reference to fruit, isn't it? And I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. It simply means it's forbidden for the people to eat the fruit during those years. But, Renee, I really think there's more here than just increasing productivity of the fruit trees. I think there's some symbolism here as well. I think that's the practical side of it. But I think there's some significance here. The ground is cursed according to what happened after the fall, and all of man's work is futile and uncircumcised apart from God. We need to understand that. The Bible is very clear apart from God, work has no meaning. Maybe that's why the people that aren't Christians are trying to get rich by the lottery, because their work has no meaning for them anymore. You see, for those who are believers, work has spiritual significance. One writer also suggested that this forbidding the eating of the trees when they got into the land was a memorial to the forbidden tree in the Garden of Eden. And that one of the reasons that they did not eat of these trees, the most natural thing in the world to want to eat of those fruit trees when they harvested, when they came ripe, but that God said you're not to eat of it, it was a test of their obedience. Just like the tree in the garden was a test of man's obedience. I thought that was an interesting idea. I wanted to share that with you. Let's move on to the fifth commandment, where we get into the sanctity of the family. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land that the Lord your God has given you. This is the citation of the commandment. There are two phrases that are added in Deuteronomy that do not appear in Exodus. As the Lord your God commanded you, and that it may go well with you in the land which the Lord God has given you. So those two additional phrases appear in Deuteronomy. Now, I think it's important to notice right off the position of the fifth commandment among the ten. The first four commandments were summed up in Deuteronomy 6:5, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. Now, summarize for me quickly the first four commandments. Not the whole quote, just the summary. Missy? You shall have what? Commandment one. What's commandment one, Missy? No other gods before me. What's commandment two, Renee?
Not making an image.
No graven image. Commandment number three. Do not misuse the name of the Lord your God. And then commandment number four. Remember the Sabbath day. And see, all four of those relate to man's obligation to God, in a sense, don't they? Okay, so the first four commands then are summed up, love the Lord your God with all your heart. The last six commands are summed up in Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus used both of these commands as summary statements of what was involved in the Ten Commandments. But is the fifth command more closely related to what precedes or what follows? Now, some think it's more closely related to what precedes, which would make it part of that love the Lord your God, because they view parents as God's agents in the life of the child growing up. And therefore, they see the fifth command really as relating to your obligation to God. Okay? Now, here in the commandment five, however you regard it, whether you see it as relating more to what precedes or relating more to what follows, the important thing to see is that the focus is shifting from the creator to the procreator. To the creator who created everything to start with, from him to the one who gave us individually our life, meaning our mother and our father. Or none of us would be here without our mother and our father. We owe our lives to them both. So the focus then of this commandment is on the family, the role of the family. Modern man has the idea of a man-centered concept of the family. The man-centered concept of the family is that the family is a social institution which must now evolve into a larger collectivity or family known as the state. That's Marxism. Marxism would do away with the family if it could. They tried that in China. They tried it for a while. I think now they've gone back to families, but they had communals, basically, trying their best to do away with the family structure. The biblical, God-centered concept is that the family is a divinely ordained institution which carries out God's purpose for man and functions to the glory of God. The family is very basic in God's program, and through the family, God carries forth his purposes. Back in Genesis, there are what are called the seven ordinances of creation. The first of these deals with procreation, having children. The last of them deals with marriage. So of the seven ordinances of creation, two of the seven deal with family life. The mandate to subdue all of the earth was given to man in the married state. Thus it becomes the purpose of the family The man and his wife are God's agents to subdue the earth, to act as God's viceroys over the earth. In Marxism, authority is transferred to the state, and the only function of the family is to produce children. And even this sometimes is subject to the state. Now, with artificial insemination, it seems to me one can imagine a society down the road in the future where there will be no such thing as families as we now know them. It's almost that way today in our country, isn't it? The breaking up of families has almost de facto done away with family. Even though there's been no law to outlaw family, in effect, there are a lot of people running around without families, aren't there? And maybe some of you come from a situation like that. The meaning of the family is not in procreation, but is in God-centered authority, according to the Bible, and responsibility in terms of man's calling to have dominion over the earth. Man is called to have dominion over the earth, and he does that through family structure. Now, what is the role of the parents? The father, his role is extending God's government to all creation. That's his call as a husband and a father. And that's the call of the family as an institution. The role of the mother, she is to be, according to the scriptures, the easer. The easer means helper, a divinely given help to man in the exercise of his dominion. And hands are up all over the place. Let's get it. Mark first.
Our question was, why would a woman be a helper? And I have four reasons.
Good.
I found four reasons, whether they're true or not.
Well, that's
that
all right.
Women were necessary. The first one is man needed a woman in order to reproduce. And man is a social being, and he needs a society of some kind. And she was needed that she might become a type of the bride of the Redeemer, a type of the church.
I understand.
And the last one is a plan of redemption is based on the seed of the woman.
All of those are good. I would say none of them really hit the nail on the head in terms of the way I see it, as she being the assistant to, with her husband.
The last one I found, another thing I found was she was created because of the mutual support that continues through her life.
And all that's good. All that's good, but I'm not sure it catches the real spirit of the biblical emphasis. Martha, I think, had her hand up next.
One other thing that was different, that was that man's nature demanded for its completion, physically, intellectually, and socially, was included in woman.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. Jim?
This is Matthew Henry's comments on a help meet for man. He treats that a couple of different ways. One, a help like him, one of the same nature and rank of being. A help near him, one to cohabit with him and to be always at hand. A help before him, one that he should look upon with pleasure and delight. And then the final, there's some other things, but the final thing I had to say, it says, a suitable wife is a help meet and is from the Lord. The relationship is likely to be comfortable when meetness directs and determines the choice, and mutual helpfulness is the constant care and endeavor.
And Matthew Henry has some tremendous things to say about marriage and family and his commentary on Genesis. Some of it's quoted even to this day in marriage ceremonies. Really good stuff on marriage and family. That's all good stuff, folks. I appreciate that, those insights. Okay, now back to my boring notes. She is the helper, and the basic idea of that word is companionship. In his calling, what's his calling? Subdue the earth. What's her calling? To help him do that. Okay? As one writer puts it, here is a community, small community, two people, in a community in authority. That is, authority has been given to this community with clear preeminence being the man's. Not using preeminent in the sense of lording it over, but in the biblical sense that the commission is his and she is his associate. As one writer puts it, she has authority like that of the prime minister to the king. Now, a king exercises his authority through the prime minister. And the prime minister, as we all know, in a country where they have a king, is considered to be the highest ranking official beside the king in the country, and has enormous authority. And I think sometimes that we do not emphasize enough the authority of the mother within the family. And that authority is under the leadership of her husband, but she has authority there. And it's God-given authority for her in that family situation. By the way, this word Ezer is also used of God. God is said to be a help to man. So some women say, oh, a woman's just a helper. But God is called an Ezer too. And if it's a put-down to call a woman a helper, then it's a put-down, according to the Bible, to call God a helper. And the same term, I like to think of it this way, that the woman is the God-given helper. It's God's way. By providing a good wife to a man, this is God's way of helping the man fulfill his responsibilities in this world. And so that's the way I look at it. Now, Friedman recently has analyzed this word Ezer and traced it back to a different root, which he claims it means, the phrase means, instead of a help suitable for him, it means a power equal to him. And so right now, this whole issue of just exactly what did God mean when he says, I will make a help, an easer, suitable for man. Did he mean a helper? That's tracing it back to one Hebrew root. Or did he mean a power, a strength equal to him? In either case, I think the Genesis narrative makes very clear the inherent equality of women. The inherent equality of women. They are made, the last thing that God created was the woman on day six. And she was created from material twice refined. He was created from the dust or the clay. She was created from the rib, which means that she was created from better material than he was created from. And so really, if you read Genesis carefully, the emphasis there is on the position of the woman as an honored position, as a cherished position, but as one in which, in the marriage relationship, a woman takes a step like Jesus took when he came into this world. He was equal with God, was he not? And he chose for our salvation, for God's purpose, to take a step down, to empty himself of that, and come into this world. A woman who chooses to marry a man, she has that choice. She's not required by law to marry, nor are men required by law to marry, either God's law or man's law, either one. But she chooses to marry, she takes a little step down from that equality to recognize that in this community of authority, that he will be the head and she will be the God divinely provided helper in that relationship. And with enormous authority in that family situation, but still, she has voluntarily chosen to surrender a little bit of that equality, because you cannot have two perfectly equal people in a community of two. It's just inevitable that there are going to be decisions that have to be made where there will be a difference of opinion. And so there has to be one of the two who's going to be give deference to the other in those kinds of situations. So that's what we're talking about here. Now, the responsibility of parents toward their children is, of course, to love them, to support them with material goods, biblically speaking, to discipline them. Boy, is that something lacking today. To discipline their children. Parents owe this to children. Children do not sense love if they are not disciplined. In fact, drawing the circles of discipline, drawing the lines and telling a child, you do not go beyond this line, and if you go beyond this line, there will be some consequences, is a way of telling that child, I care about you. I love you enough to say, this is where you belong. Children are constantly searching, testing what the parameters of their freedom might be. And if they have absolute freedom, they conclude that they are not loved and appreciated. And the parents who, in the misguided Dr. Spock notion of let them do whatever they want to do their own thing, is misguided, it's unbiblical, it does not work in practice, as anybody who's ever raised children can tell you, and as you can observe from yourself, when you see children that are undisciplined, creating havoc in public places and slapping their parents and running their parents ragged and disobeying their parents. You can observe for yourself that kind of libertarian philosophy, just just does not work in child raising. And even if it did, the Bible says that's not the best way to raise a child. And another responsibility of parents along with that is to instruct them in the things of God. That is the responsibility of parents. And that can be done in many different ways. You can do it verbally, of course, through singing little songs, by observing the Israelites, by observing the proper rituals. Attitude of the parents toward the Lord's Supper will teach a child a lot. I'm not sure where I stand on the issue of junior worship. I think you can make an argument both ways on junior worship, junior church. I've flip-flopped myself two or three times, but it just seems like to me those children need to see the adults in a worship posture. And I know there's a lot of distraction and all of that. I understand. Like last night, we had a little baby behind me, real behind me, just distracted me through the whole worship service. And mother didn't have the sense to take it out. You get that once in a while. But I think in balance, that those children, it's important for them to see mother and father taking communion, bowing their heads, praying, singing, and to learn that these things mean a great deal to their mother and their father. Where are they going to learn that? Yes?
If parents would do what was right and teach their children at home, there wouldn't be nothing.
All right, now let's analyze that. Now, wait a minute. I thought you were going to go somewhere else. I cut in there too soon. You're saying...
Junior, okay. Because of how parents don't teach their kids at home, you have to have junior church to even teach the kids.
Okay. Well, now let me make an observation here. Of course, the Old Testament emphasized the responsibility of parents to teach their children at home. Right?
Right.
Now, understand why the Old Testament emphasized that so much was because they had no public worship. They never got together as a congregation like we do. Now, let me point out something. I'm not trying to say Christian parents should not teach their children at home, but the nature of Christianity is different from the nature of the Hebrew religion of the Old Testament. And the concept of the New Testament is that God has given various talents to people in the body. Is that true in the church? People have different talents. Now, if there is a young lady in our church or an older lady that God has given a marvelous talent for teaching young people, some people have that talent. We know that, don't we? Some of you have the talent of teaching children that I would never have in a million years. You could do more with those children in an hour than I could do in ages. So part of the genius of the church is that we are a family, an extended family, and we trust one another. We bring our children to Sunday school or to the youth program because we are a family. We are a larger family. Now I think sometimes we've laid another guilt trip on parents. I'm not saying parents shouldn't do their job at home. Don't misunderstand me. I'm just saying as a matter of emphasis. Now, let me tell you where I'm coming from. We used to have a guy work with us in Cincinnati. He was a nut. I'm glad he's gone from there now. But in those days, he was telling the people that Sunday school should not be for Christians. That was his argument. Maybe that's where you're getting. I hope not. But his argument was Sunday school should not be for Christians. Parents should teach kids at home. Christian parents should teach their kids at home. And Sunday school should just be for the children of the families that are not Christian. And I said, no, I called him in one day because the kids were really getting all messed up in their minds. And I said, where did you get that in the Bible? Well, start quoting these passages from Deuteronomy. You know, teach them when you stand up and teach them when you lie down and teach them when you walk in the way. Yes, okay, I said, that's true. But they never met on Sabbath day collectively. There wasn't any other way to teach them. It was that or nothing. Under the Christian system, it's not that or nothing. And a young person can learn a lot of things. If you get a young person, let's look at the worst case scenario of a child who's getting no religious instruction at home, period. And he's brought to church by someone else. If you have a good school program, Sunday school program, you have a good youth program at night, you have a good vacation Bible school, a good camp program, that young person can learn an awful lot about the things of the Lord, and there's some of them right here in Bible College today who have no home support whatsoever because they were brought to church and trained. Now, that, you know, that's the worst case scenario where you're getting no home support. Okay? So let's don't get too radical. That's all I'm saying. Let's don't get too radical and say all of the training should be at home. I mean, that we should, of course, try to teach our children at all times and under all circumstances. But we have something that they did not have in Old Testament times. It's called the Sunday school, and it's a marvelous invention. And we even have Christian day schools, which are even more marvelous. And so we're not restricted to what they might learn at home. If they learn it at home, good, but we're not going to let that hold us back.
At our church, we have a children's church, and it used to be a slightly more in the room where there was a, it kind of looked like a church. It had two aisles and had a piano and a pulpit. And he had an elder come in to give communion when it was time. They sang hymns and everything. But then on the fifth Sunday of every month, they'd go in with their parents and stuff it that way. So then they can see where their parents are doing it too. And it's just the same, they do the same kind of service.
That's good. If you're going to have a junior church, I think it's imperative that at least once a month they go in and worship with it.
If you did like what that guy was talking about, the only folks in Sunday school were the folks who got no instruction at home, and you got no positive peer pressure in there from the other kids and stuff. And
good
you
point.
Have just an unruly
good
group.
Good point.
Wouldn't know anything about how to behave.
I think what Bill was getting at is one reason they have to have junior church nowadays. I don't agree with it. I wish they didn't have to have it. But one of the reasons they have to have it is because the parents aren't disciplining their kids at home, and they're a distraction when they're in with the adults. That's why they have to be entertained somewhat.
That's
to
true.
Keep them ruly.
No, I'm for it if anyone misunderstood. I'm for junior church.
We understand.
I'm just saying.
You're a radical. We understand.
I'm just saying because I know that where I minister at, where I'm a youth minister at, even at home the kids don't have any positive anything, and sometimes only at junior church they can see with collectively with all the other kids and my teaching, and that might be their only form of worship ever.
Yes, your comment.
I was going to say, our elders saw that there were a couple of children coming and didn't either have fathers or fathers weren't present in services. So they've asked, and we run the children with the adults right up to scripture reading time for the sermon, at which time they go out to their own study session. And
now that sounds to me like a happy compromise. I kind of like that. That's sort of getting the best of both. Kids are getting a message on their level, and yet they're seeing their parents in the worship frame, and I like that. That sounds to me like a good way to do it, rather than try to do the whole program by itself.
It works.
I like that. I'm going to suggest that up at our church, in fact. Well, how do we get off on all these interesting tangents? We're talking about the responsibility of parents to train children. I'm just interested in one feeling or impression that you're gaining. Now, you girls are working out at Kissimmee School and different Sunday schools and things. What percentage of homes would you say are giving any kind of formal, as opposed to just comments around the table or something, religious training at home? What's your impression? Are we talking? What's the situation? Let me ask you, would you be embarrassed if I asked you in your own homes how many of you had a devotion time or family time on a regular, consistent basis through your childhood years? Family time. Okay. Donald's? I honestly don't, in my home, you know, preacher's home, I don't remember without my parents ever. I mean, Mom would come and tell some Bible stories on an irregular basis, but I don't remember we ever had family devotions and prayer at the table, but nothing like, that. So, it's a problem. It's a problem. It really is. Well, another responsibility of parents, to model an honorable life. Now, you see, when it says honor your father and mother, there's a responsibility also here on the parents to live the kind of lives that make them honorable. To be honored, one must be honorable. In the eyes of the small child, parents represent God. And so therefore the parents must act in such a way as they deserve that honor. They have a responsibility to train those children for their highest calling. What is the highest calling these children will ever be involved in? Now, whether you ever thought of it or not, but the highest calling is going to be to become part of a family themselves someday, of another family, of starting another family. That's the highest calling that any of us will ever have in this world, in God's program. That's a higher calling than being a preacher or a missionary or anything else. It's to simply form a new family under the authority of God. And we have to train our children in our homes to do that. To do that. And to leave for them an inheritance. I really become convicted that parents ought to be thrifty enough to set aside something that when they leave this world, they're able to leave behind something to their children. I think that should be something we all strive for with our families. And most of you are just in the process of starting families. But I know under the pressure of trying to provide the here and now, the immediate, that sometimes we forget the long range. And I think that's part of our responsibility. Now there are some limitations on parental authority. The general limitation is God's higher claim. And under the Old Testament law, that was acknowledged through circumcision, through redemption of the firstborn. God had a higher claim on everybody's children. But there are specific limitations. For example, they could not execute. Parents did not have the authority to execute a child. Now, in pagan society, they did. Father didn't like what his kid did. He had killed. No problem there. No juvenile delinquency there. But Israelite parents could not do that. They would have to bring their child who was unruly, who was a juvenile delinquent, to the judges. They would have to press charges against their own child. There would have to be a court case. And if death were to be ordered, the parents had to be... I was going to say they were the ones required to throw the stones. That's the one case where the witnesses were not required to throw the stones. The law did not require the parents to actually throw the stones at their own children, but they had to bear testimony against them in a court of law if they were incorrigible juvenile delinquents. Now, parents could not offer child sacrifice. They should be awful and not off. Could not offer child sacrifice. Didn't have that limitation. They could not sell a daughter into prostitution. That was very common in the ancient world. Now, we will study, and that should be lesson 15, a father could sell, quote unquote, his daughter into marriage, although it wasn't really equivalent to a sale in the sense that that we use that word today. When we get to lesson 15, you'll see what I'm talking about. Parents could not abuse a child. Now, I derive that from the law that says if a slave owner were required to avoid physical abuse and discipline, how much more parents? Because children were considered of higher worth than a slave. And the law specifically forbid the physical abuse of a slave, how much more a child was not to be physically abused. Now the commandment, honor. What is involved in that honor? We have a duty here. This is a positive command, something we are to do in a positive sense. And it's a necessary command. If it were natural for people to honor their father and their mother, they wouldn't have to make a commandment. God never made a commandment that says eat, because that's natural. God never made a commandment that said breathe, because that's natural. The fact we have a commandment here, whether you realize it or not, means that we're dealing with something that is not natural. Therefore, God has commanded his people to be different and to honor their father and their mother. It's an absolute command. There is a basic respect required of God for all parents by their children. But if your parents happen to be of the righteous kind, and they tried to raise you right, and now that you're growing up, you may not have appreciated it at the time, but looking back on it, you see what they were trying to do. They weren't perfect, but what they were trying to do, then you owe them special kind of respect, according to the scripture. This is a universal command because everyone has parents. So everybody has that obligation. That is a difficult command. Notice the command is to honor, not obey. It's a lot easier to obey. You can grit your teeth and obey. You may not like it, but you can do that. But this command is harder than just obey. It's honor. It's a weighty command. Several times this verb is used with God as the object. We are to honor God. Same verb used here, honoring parents. Sometimes the verb is translated glorify and describes how God is to be worshipped. Now, that doesn't, I'm not suggesting we're to worship our parents, but I'm saying it's the same word. It's trying to give you an idea, a mental conception of what God is expecting here in the law, to honor your parents. The same way he commands us to honor him. Now, what's involved in this honoring then? First, involved is respecting the source of life. The law required respect for the source of life in the animal kingdom. Yes, you have a report.
I've got some research on this.
Go.
The issue of boiling a kid is another note to talk about earlier.
Good.
Kyle Dielich said this, to do that was a contempt of the relation which God had established and sanctified between the parent and the young.
Now, did everybody hear that? I hope you're listening to these reports, because there's been some tremendous stuff presented here today. I don't see anybody taking any notes now, not because you aren't going to remember. But that's what the law says, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. I say that again, Dave, for the benefit of the slow of mind.
It indicated a contempt of the relation which God had established and sanctified between parent and young, and thus subverted the divine ordinance.
All right. And that's what its relationship is to this commandment, right?
That's a possible relationship.
Okay, good.
The second idea, which I thought was probably more feasible, is one that Rodman gave. He said this verse has been often interpreted as the prohibition of Canaanite ritual. And he quotes from Shakar and Shalim, or something like that, by G.R. Driver. And the quote is this: over the fire seven times, the sacrificers cook a kid in milk and mint in butter. And over the cauldron seven times fresh water is poured. So it's part of their pagan ritual to do that combination of a goat with its mother milk.
Good. That's in the Brodman commentary?
Brodman commentary.
Good. I'll copy your notes when you turn them in. I wasn't aware of that. I knew it was a pagan ritual, but I didn't have the documentation. So good. Good. Something else? Yes.
Basically, that's what he had, but one addition was... In our textbook, it said certainly these injunctions were given to foster humane sensitivities in people, but they were also aimed at fostering a regard for life.
Okay. And that's the aspect under which I'm bringing it down here, too. I don't deny that it was pagan, and it's that they may have done this in paganism, but that just moves it back a step further. What were the pagans doing? The pagans were undercutting this relationship of parent and child, you see. Not only with that, but with child sacrifice and the whole ball of wax. So I don't deny that the pagans did this, but I think there's something more fundamental than just forbidding it because the pagans did it. I think that it's forbidden not just because the pagans did it, but because by doing it, the pagans were undercutting this relationship between parent and offspring. And that's what we're getting at here in this commandment. Okay, so the issue here... The issue here, the law respected required the respect for the source of life in the animal kingdom. Let's look a couple of these verses up here. Leviticus 22:27. Leviticus 22:27. Who has that? And somebody else get ahead there and look up Deuteronomy 22:6-7. So we don't waste any time. All right, Leviticus 22:27.
When a calf, a lamb, or a goat is born and is to remain with his mother for 7 days, from the eighth day on it will be acceptable as an offering made to the Lord by fire.
Now, isn't that interesting? The calf was to remain with its mother for 7 days before it could be offered up to the Lord as an offering. Now, why such a rule? Again, it's the respecting of this relationship. The mother and the calf were not to be separated during those earliest days. There just seemed to be something inhumane about that. What about Deuteronomy 22:6-7?
If you come across a bird's nest beside the road, either in a tree or on the ground, and the mother is sitting on the young or on the eggs, do not take the mother with the young. You may take the young, but be sure to let the mother go, so that it may go well with you and you may have a long life.
Okay, again, what's involved in these kinds of laws? Not just simply the preservation of man's food supply, but humane feelings toward lower animals. The idea is that all life is the handiwork of God, and men must deal with all life according to the terms of God's law. There's a promise of life also extended for honoring the source of life among animals, just like there is about honoring the source of life with your parents. Look at Deuteronomy 22, 6 and 7. Is that the one you just read? And did it bring out a promise of life that it may go well with you? Okay, that's the point I want to bring out. The idea that you're humane to animals, God promises a special blessing upon your life. Isn't that neat? All you animal lovers are particularly relate to that. Now, we need to recognize also, by honoring our parents, what are we doing? We are recognizing the inheritance of life. We inherited from our parents life, of course. But more than that, we inherited their wisdom and we inherited their experience. To rebel against our elders, meaning our parents, is to disinherit ourselves. The world we entered was not naked. It was already here, believe it or not, a long time before you got here. And a lot of things that you enjoy are the fruits of people who've gone on before you. And that's what we're trying to inculcate in this commandment, is the idea of respecting that which went before you in this life, particularly your parents. So observing the honoring of the parents recognizes that progress is rooted in the past. Every step of progress we make is based upon something accomplished by someone before. Even marriage, which calls for a leaving of the family and a cleaving to the wife and setting up of a new family unit, does not relieve us from the obligation of honoring our father and our mother. Now go down here to Americana Nursing Home and see how many parents are in there that have been abandoned. Or for the most part, the children only come around when they're talking about what they might get from the inheritance. But isn't that true? Some of you have been to Americana. Isn't that true? A lot of people in there that no one comes to see. Children have totally abandoned. Okay, we're going to go on with the fifth commandment next week. I hope I'll recall it sometime.